You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Some people are fascinated by them. Others experience abject fear at the sight of one. The Chinese calendar celebrated them in 2013 as thoughtful, wise, and focused on detail. The creature in question, the snake, is estimated by the American Veterinary Medical Association that over 1 million snakes are kept as pets in the U.S. They're gorgeous, can be a challenge to care for, come with a unique set of health concerns, and often a hefty price tag. My guest is Dr. Elliot Jacobson, Professor Emeritus at the University of Florida School of Veterinary Medicine and a diplomate of the American College of Zoological Medicine. He has spent his veterinary career advancing the health and welfare of captive and wild reptiles. We'll be right back after the short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Pet Life Radio, the number one pet radio network on the planet, joins forces with iHeartRadio to put the power of your pets in your pocket.
Awesome.
Download the iHeartRadio app and rock Pet Life Radio on your phone, on your tablet, on your Xbox, in your car. Pet talk, pet tunes, and fun pet times. Pet Life Radio and iHeartRadio. Positively possum.
It's dinner time in America, where more pet parents trust PetSmart for natural and expert-recommended foods than any place else. And now, we've added more than 100 new varieties to our already wide selection of your favorite brands, like Simply Nourish, Authority, Wellness, Science Diet, and more. Do what's best for your pet. At PetSmart, happiness in store.
Go to PetSmartDeal.com to find out this week's coupon code and save up to 30% on food, treats, toys, and more. And get free shipping on orders of $49. Go to PetSmartDeal.com, PetSmartDeal.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Jacobson, thank you so much for being a guest today on the show.
My pleasure.
A lot of veterinarians know little, and I'm one of those, of reptile medicine. Now, you and I have a camaraderie of both having spent time at UC Davis School of Veterinary Medicine. So I was a student there, and I believe that you did a residency there. Is that correct?
No, I did a residency at the University of Florida.
Oh, it is so close, University of Florida. But you did spend some time, I believe, or you just are aware of Dr. Fowler, who is kind of one of the fathers of zoological medicine?
Yes, I met him early in my career, and I had a friend that was the first resident in his program in the early 70s. So I had visited Davis a number of times. I've given some lectures out there. And so I'm somewhat familiar with the campus and known Dr. Fowler since sometime in the 70s.
How did you get involved yourself personally with reptiles?
Well, personally, I had reptiles as pets since I was a child, probably 6 or 7 years of age. Before that, it was insects. I thought I was going to be an entomologist when I was very young for a long time, but I got attracted to reptiles. Now, I grew up in Brooklyn, New York, so there wasn't a great diversity of reptiles in Brooklyn. And so I used to go to Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey Circus when they came to town as a child. And as you walked into Madison Square Garden, they would have these pallets where turtles and baby red-eared sliders and American chameleons, American annual lizards were sold. And I just got attracted to them because of my interest in insects. I was attracted to anything that moved. And so over time, I slowly switched over from being wanting to be a entomologist to wanting to be a herpetologist. And eventually, I graduated from City University in New York at Brooklyn College in 1967 and went out to graduate school at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And then went on for my PhD at the University of Missouri, where I worked with amphibians. At New Mexico State University, I worked with snakes as my research animals. So while working with these animals, both amphibians and reptiles, I encountered a number of health disease issues. And at that time, in the early 70s, there was very, very little known about health problems of these animals. Whether as pets in the wild, there was virtually nothing. And then research animals, also virtually nothing. So I decided to go into veterinary medicine to get a better, get training in an area that I could apply to my interest in reptile health issues. And that's pretty much how it worked out.
Huh. I love it. A child growing up in Brooklyn and not really surrounded by, as you're saying, any type of reptiles to speak of. And here you are now, one of the preeminent sources of knowledge and research that's going on with amphibians and reptiles. Congratulations. That was definitely showed your fortitude in getting your background. So you mentioned amphibians. Maybe if some of the people listening going, okay, what's a reptile? What's an amphibian? If you could kind of give them a little background on that.
Sure, quickly, and it's fairly easy because I just taught a 5-day course at the American Museum of Natural History's field station in Portal, Arizona, on amphibian and reptile health issues. And so amphibians and reptiles are actually quite different. And what really separates them, one is that most or all amphibians have a moist skin. They have a very glandular skin. They secrete all types of interesting peptides from glands in their skin to the surface. And so the skin is very moist, and they can actually take oxygen and gases up through their skin and through their mouth. In reptiles, for the most part, the skin is very keratin, much more keratinized, much more thickened, and it is relatively glandular. That is, there is a lack of, for the most part, of glands in their skin compared to amphibians. So we have those two big distinctions between them. But the real thing that separates the two is the type of egg they produce. Amphibians produce a gelatinous egg, just like fish. It is an egg with an embryo surrounded by gelatinous membranes, and those eggs are generally laid in water or in a semi-aquatic environment, and they're very dependent upon water to survive and hatch. Reptiles, as a group, lay shelled eggs. That's like a chicken egg. So you have an embryo that's protected, has a lot more protection with this eggshell that is made up of calcium that surrounds it. Plus, it has a series of membranes internally that the amphibian egg doesn't have. But the big step in development going from amphibians gave rise to reptiles. We don't know what exact group. We have an idea of the group that reptiles have come off of that was an amphibian group. And so the big transformation was being able to go from really tied to water to a group of animals that could live on land at a very different ecology. So that's the easy difference between them. There are many other differences that are much more technical.
If we have 4 more days, you can go into the rest of it. I love it. Thank you.
Sure.
So with reptiles and amphibians, they do hold such a fascination for many people. And I know as a child, I had a red ear slider. You mentioned one. And sad to say, they rarely survived more than a couple of months. But there are so many things that people can do. They're not just a disposable entity. If it's a snake or if it's going to be a turtle, a tortoise, what do people need to just simplistically consider before they get one of these creatures?
Well, these animals really are a very complex group. I mean, the reptiles are 9,500 species. And the ones that we see in the pet trade are a handful of the total number of reptiles that are around the world. Most reptiles are very small. The biggest group are lizards, and there are about 4,500 species of lizards. And what we see in captivity in the pet trade is just a handful. And those are generally animals that can be bred fairly well or are semi-docile. I mean, everything bites. And you take that for granted. Nothing is perfectly tame, even dogs and cats. And so, but there's been a selection for those animals that will sell well and will do well. There is more information out today than ever before. When I grew up as a kid in the 50s, there was nothing. The insects that were sold to feed these animals were terribly deficient and resulted in certain diseases, and many of these animals did not survive very long. Also, people were not prepared for babies growing to be sizable animals. And they're very cute when they're babies, and when they become big, they're, for some people, less attractive and there's more work that needs to be done. So the person who's interested in acquiring a reptile for as a pet for their child or themselves, there is a lot of information on the web. And if you go to, there's a site called kingsnake.com, K-I-N-G, snake, S-N-A-K-E.com. And that site has all sorts of links to publications, information, and also people that are selling captive bred amphibians and reptiles that are selling animals on the web. And so it's a website that is loaded with information. So people today can go out and really search out what they may be interested in. Or if you do Google, just put in what is the best pet reptile, and you could get information that way. And prices vary considerably from fairly inexpensive for a corn snake, which makes, for me, a very good pet, could be in a pet store maybe $40 or so, up to thousands of dollars depending upon the specific animal you may be interested in. There's some very, very expensive ball pythons, which are a pretty harmless snake, but they've been bred for all kinds of colors, just like Japanese have bred koi for all different types of colors. And some of these color morphs cost tens of thousands of dollars. And
so they almost sound like designer snakes instead of designer dogs.
Exactly. These color morphs are really designer animals. There's a webpage called ballpythonworld.com, and people list all of their new color morphs on that, and I think there are over 2,000 now. Uh-huh. And some have sold for about $30,000. And so the business with ball pythons and the very expensive snakes is to be the first one on the block to have a certain color morph that other people want. And then there's, and so it does operate as an animal pyramid, unfortunately.
Dr. Jacobson, you mentioned $30,000 for a particular color morph, a certain color pattern in
yes.
a snake.
Yes.
How long is an animal like that? How long is that snake expected to live? That is a huge investment.
It is, but these are people who are going to breed it and then sell progeny, probably less than that. So if they bought for 30, maybe they'll sell it for 20. And if they have 10 eggs that all hatch with that color, they've made money. And but it's a pyramid. As the further down you go, or the more common these animals, these color morphs become, their price falls. And then eventually they go into like Petco or PetSmart. And some of these ball python breeders have contracts with these big pet companies to provide tens of thousands. And the upper limit is that you'll see in these stores is around $199. And so many of these color morphs, over a period of 5 or 6 years, their price drops precipitously as they become more common. And that's all part of the business. In the United States, there are shows called Reptile Expositions. The first one started in Florida in 91 in Orlando, and they spread now all over the country and all over the world. And basically, they're a gathering point for breeders who come to a convention center and have animals offered for sale. They have tables, and in addition to animals, they have cages and books and all the accoutrements that go along with having these animals, amphibians, complete systems for little tiny frogs, these arrow poison frogs that are like tropical fish. There are companies that specialize in putting together entire complete ecosystems in a tank for these animals. So this is big business. I mean, the reptile amphibian pet trade, I mean, there was some study done on that recently. I don't remember the exact number, but I probably purchased $1 billion.
The trade, the money that can be invested in these animals where your initial outlay may not be that large, but to do it correctly because they come from such a variety of ecosystems, seems like that must be extremely challenging to find out what is going to allow your particular animal to thrive. And I think that's where veterinarians can help, but because there aren't a lot of veterinarians such as yourself that have this type of a background, where are some reputable places they can get the information that they need?
Well, there's an American Association of Reptilian and Amphibian Veterinarians, and they have an annual meeting. They also have a lot of information on their webpage. If you just think, if you put in ARAV as a Google search, you'll come to their webpage. There's a lot of written information available. And there are courses that they have workshops, specialty courses. There are, you know, the North American Veterinary Conference is a major conference. The Western States are the major veterinary conferences that typically have wildlife, exotic animal sessions to them. So there are.
But would that be something that a general public could attend?
No, for the general public trying to be educated with these animals, much of that is going to be by what's reading. There's a lot of information out there on and going to these expos. These expos are in every single state, probably multiple cities. Every big city just about has one. And there's a lot of information given out. And there you can actually meet tables of breeders and then ask them very specific questions. And so those expos are a great place for learning. And they often have lectures with them the night before the actual expo opens to sell animals. Generally, they have in the evening a whole series of lectures on husbandry and care of different species. And then there is the IHS, the International Herpetological Symposium, which is held annually around the country, and it is geared for husbandry and reproduction of reptiles in captivity, and that's open to whoever wants to register to go to the meeting. So there are a number of different avenues for people to become educated. And also, YouTube has some pretty amazing videos on how to set up an aquarium for, say, arrow poison frogs, or how to feed certain snakes. So YouTube has a wide range of videos on how-to that are geared to the person keeping these animals as pets.
Dr. Elliott, some great information. Right now we're speaking with Dr. Elliott Jacobson, Professor Emeritus, University of Florida School of Veterinary Medicine, and a diplomate of the American College of Zoological Medicine. We'll be right back after this short break. Want to talk about these. Maybe you have a reptile, you're doing a great job, it's getting a little too big. Now what do you do with it? Do you just let it go? We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Dogs leave fur wherever they go. It collects all over the home. There are many tools designed to stop dog hair spreading, but their effectiveness varies, and afterwards you have to clean the tool, then the floor. With the Dyson Groom Tool, you simply deploy the bristles, then gently brush the coat. Loose fur is removed, while dead skin and allergens are captured by the vacuum. And to clean up, you simply release the trigger.
To get this awesome Dyson Groom Tool, go to DysonDeals.com. That's DysonDeals.com.
Hi, this is Jody Miller-Young from Bark and Swagger. Tune in for everything pet fashion and more, from fashion tips and runway trends, products and designs I love, to fabulous home decor for your furry friend. You'll find it all here. Be the first to discover the new. So what are you waiting for? Find me on Pet Life Radio. And remember, when fierce fashion calls, bark and swagger.
Every week, on demand, only on PetLifeRadio.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Jacobson, you mentioned earlier, okay, you were born in Brooklyn. You got attracted to reptiles. Too many people will get these little alligator lizards or other types of reptiles. They're doing a pretty good job. And as you said, it keeps getting bigger and bigger. It's like, now what do I do with this thing? Oftentimes, you know, there's the stories about these crocodiles, alligators being let go into the sewer system there in New York, and probably more of an urban legend and myth, but I know you're in Florida, and there's a real problem in the Everglades of people having previously, and probably still, letting go of their snakes. Tell us about why that's such a horrible idea.
Well, Florida is challenged with invasive species, more so than any other state in the country. California, too, has a number of invasive species that people have released into the environment because these are relatively warm states with mild climates. There are certain areas in those states that a lot of tropical animals can complete their life cycle and live. Southern Florida is one of the best examples in the Everglades and area, and Big Cypress Preserve, which takes up 1.5 million acres, 2 million acres in southern Florida. And when you have a somewhat primitive area like that, because it is in certain ways, and surrounded then on each coast by cities, it's a very unique place. And also you have a lot of animal dealers that are around the Everglades and these systems, especially on the East Coast. And there's been a lot of animal movements through Florida because of it's a major import city for all types of exotic animals. In the past, it used to be birds, but that has been eliminated pretty much. And so
they're invasive. You let them go in the Everglades. It thrives. Again, there are these stories of these huge boas that are, you know, you can find in the Everglades. But besides just being there, what's the problem of having that snake in an environment that, what's the problem of it being an invasive species?
Well, this is a very controversial topic, which there are books written about invasive species and impact. And to make it simple, the problem with invasive, and this is also invasive plants. South Florida has probably way, way more invasive plants than animals. And people don't see it because a tree is a tree is a tree. But there's like the Malaleuca, which has almost destroyed the Everglades, that was brought in sometime in the early part of the last century. And so there are all kinds of invasive living things out there. Animals are one part of it. Another thing, at another time we can talk about, are feral cats. I mean, they're basically an invasive species in, 4 to 6 million in Florida. And so that's a whole other issue to talk about, impact of our free-ranging wildlife from these domestic animals that have been released. And so this is all a problem of poor pet ownership. The reptiles that have escaped or been released is poor pet ownership. The majority of owners are not like that. But there are outliers that cause problems for everyone else. And we see that all the time. I live on a road where neighbors don't follow leash laws at all. We do. All our dogs are fenced in. But most people don't. They let their animals run free. And you can imagine with exotics what happens. So you can't even get good control of domestic animals. Exotics are on another level of difficulty.
But these exotics can carry quite a few different diseases, too, that they can take into the wild and then also destroy a lot of the local wildlife. Isn't that true?
Yeah, potentially. But feral cats have caused a lot of problems with toxoplasmosis in aquatic systems in California. And so the point I'm trying to make, and I don't want to pick on one group, is that there are problems with all groups of animals that, you know, are not native and get established in areas. And whether it's mammals, birds, or reptiles, there has been problems with pet ownership. And those are not, once they get going, once they get established, it is almost impossible to really control them. In the Everglades, we have the Burmese python as the primary big. It's a big predator. It gets up to 16 feet, 17 feet or so, 200 pounds. And there are papers published now that claim it has resulted in a reduction or a loss of certain mammals that used to be common in the Everglades system. That's still open to debate is the true impact of those animals. Boa constrictors, they've established themselves at one state park. south of Miami, and they got established in 1970, and they have not moved from that area. So they're very, very confined. And these animals are very temperature. Most of the tropical reptiles and amphibians are very temperature sensitive. They are limited by, you know, how far north they are able to move by the number, probably by the number of freezing days. The more freezing days you have, the less likely some of these species are going to be able to move into those areas. And if you look at global warming, if that's happening, or climate change, and if things warm, then maybe they can move further north. But right now, they are pretty much restricted to the very southern part of Florida.
Dr. Jacobson, you're talking about movement, and one of the things I think that's interesting is your research, and that definitely has to do with movement. So inclusion body disease that you've been studying in these pythons, and how you could have a totally inapparently a snake that does not appear to be ill at all, who can be taking this disease throughout the trade area. Tell us a little bit about your research of inclusion body disease, what it looks like, what can be done to determine if a snake has this particular disease.
Well, inclusion body disease is named because of characteristic structures in the cells of affected animals. An animal that has inclusion body disease has what are called inclusions that are in the cytoplasm, and they're bodies that you can differentially stain. So you can take a piece of a sample of tissue and process it, just like a person getting a biopsy. The best thing to think of, getting a biopsy, that piece of tissue is made into a microscopic slide, and then the pathologist reads it and gives you a report on what is seen. And inclusion body disease, same thing, a piece of tissue is taken, and it is made into a microscopic slide, and a pathologist can discern the presence or absence of these inclusions in the cytoplasm, which have a very characteristic stain and shape, and that's what we call a presumptive diagnosis. There are other things that need to be done to conclusively diagnose what that is. But
what would make a pet owner think that their snake has this disease? What would be the clinical signs?
There's a range of clinical signs. The most common one that people will see are signs of neurological disease. The animal may have, if you put it on its back, simply it cannot right itself, which it should be able to do very quickly. Most will resist being put on their back. Their head may go straight up in the air, pointing to the stars, and which is not a normal, typical behavior. They may circle. Their body may completely around in a circle, and some of them go completely limp. They have a paralysis. That is one of the major signs that is seen. And
is it a fatal disease?
From what we understand, no animal gets better. They may be chronically ill for a long period of time and eventually die because people will continue to feed them. And some die a little quicker, and some take a long period of time to die. But once they have this, invariably it's fatal. Now,
how is it spread?
Well, we don't know for sure. We believe it's either animal-to-animal contact. It could be through the egg, you know, through the reproductive system. And often snakes that have this disease in a collection have mite. There is a common mite found on snakes, and that may be involved in the transmission. We have the molecular tools today now to try and sort that out, and hopefully they'll be sorted out over the next couple of years.
If, in general, as we somewhat wrap up right now, and my guest is Dr. Elliot Jacobson, what would be the number one health concern for people owning captive reptiles? If you could distill it into maybe 3 points, what are the things that they really need to be aware of?
The number one thing in terms of health problems going from reptiles to humans is salmonella. And it can be summed up in that one word. Salmonella is present in a wide variety of reptiles. We just assume it's present in almost everything we work with, but that isn't necessarily the case. There are some that we found to, by culture, be salmonella-free. But we take that position because, just like I assume every single cat is carrying Pasteurella in its mouth, that a bite from a cat to me is a very, very significant health problem. I get bitten by a cat, I'm on antibiotics. I've been bitten by a lot of animals, and I don't necessarily go on antibiotics. Salmonella is, so it's common, but also can be dealt with, because salmonella is now food, and we're exposed to, and now dog food can have salmonella. So salmonella is something that's around. And with reptiles, the main thing is to wash up. These animals, little children should not be handling them unless they're very, very strictly supervised. But whoever handles them needs to just wash up after they're done and not touch their mouth. And to be aware of touching your hands on faucets and doorknobs, and no different than having influenza infection and you're blowing your nose and then you touch a hand, a doorknob, and you spread it around. So, salmonella gets spread around just like many other potential pathogens can be spread around. The biggest
thing. So hygiene's important. Good. Okay.
That's number one. That's it. If you do that, your risk goes down dramatically. And aside from that, there's very little that reptiles can. There are a handful of offbeat pathogens that potentially can get into humans, some parasites, a few other things, but no different than from our domestic animals. So aside from salmonella, I consider everything else at a much, much lower level. But proper hygiene should be done if you have any animal pets.
Great. Dr. Jacobson, this has really been very interesting. Thank you very much for being a guest today.
Sure.
It really goes to show, no matter what type of animal you're trying to bring into the home, do your research beforehand. Make sure you have a good source of information on giving it good veterinary medical care, because once you bring it into the home, it's for life, their life. So Dr. Jacobson, again, thank you so much for being a guest today.
My pleasure, and I'll be glad to answer any questions that may arise.
All right, so we will keep you to that word. We'll have a listing on our homepage. Thank you so much for listening.
Right.
This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You're listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Please listen again next week. We'll have more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening. Take care.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.